so I used the time to introduce myself to several women, taking a few minutes to get myself noticed as the newcomer before heading to the food area. The aromas of cinnamon, yeast bread, and coffee titillate my olfactory nerves as I move closer to the tack room. I'm exchanging pleasantries with a cute 20-something woman who is expecting her first child, when I notice a line of sorts has formed, and I'm somewhere in the middle of it. Through the crowd, I catch a glimpse of the cause. A quiver of anxiety ripples through me at the sight of Eli Schrock standing in the doorway, greeting everyone as they enter the room. He takes his time and seems to relish speaking with each and every member of his congregation. I watch him carefully as I move ever closer. He shakes the hands of both men and women. With an elderly woman, he takes her hand into both of his and bows his head slightly as he speaks to her. He holds the most elevated position in the church district, and yet he's respectful of his female elders. Even from a distance, I discern his charisma. He's engaging and attentive, with a demeanor that oozes benevolence and beckons trust. But there's a power there, too, and the strength to make the tough decisions when needed. The woman behind me says something. I turn to her, and we exchange a pleasantry. Then suddenly, it's my turn. Eli Schrock stands just 2 feet away. So close, I can smell him. A combination of hand soap, alfalfa hay, and coffee. Tilting his head, his eyes find mine, and in that instant, the rest of the crowd melts away. Anxiety scratches at the back of my neck as he scrutinizes me. I know it the moment he realizes he's never met me, and he steps closer. Bowing my head slightly, I extend my hand. "It was a good preaching service," I say in Pennsylvania Dutch.
"Humility is the way of the Lord."
His hand closes over mine. I'm keenly aware of the heat of it, the scuff of calluses against my skin. His eyes are dark brown, nearly black, but a light seems to radiate from within.
"You're the widow from Ohio," he says.
The statement takes me aback. I know better than most how quickly word of a newcomer travels among the Amish. Still, I'm surprised he knows who I am. "I'm Kate Miller, and I'm happy to be here, Bishop."
"We welcome you."
He's still gripping my hand, looking at me with such intensity that I struggle to maintain my poise.
"You'll be living permanently here in Roaring Springs?"
he asks. "Yes." I'm cognizant of the woman standing behind me, waiting her turn. Schrock doesn't seem to notice her. He's still holding my hand, looking at me intently, unhurried.
"You're planning to join the church?"
"As soon as possible."
"Good."
He releases my hand.
"We'll make it official next Sunday."
He turns his attention to the woman behind me. Giving myself a small mental shake, I continue on. Chapter 10. The tack room bustles with activity. It's 10 degrees warmer than the rest of the barn, and filled with conversation in Deutsch. Suggs had told me there are approximately 150 people in the community. I don't know if that's an official number, but I'm guessing the number is closer to 200. Many of the teenagers have already eaten and fled. Sunday is a big day for socializing for them. Chances are there will be a singing later, and I'm betting a few of the boys have gone off someplace private to smoke cigarettes. Because they're teenagers and not yet baptized, the adults won't give them too much static. I make my way to the place where I left the date pudding, plasticware, and serving spoon, and I busy myself filling the dessert cups. I've filled a dozen or so when I see Mary's daughter, Anna, looking at me from across the room. She's standing a few feet from her ma'am, looking bored and hungry. I motion her over.
"Would you like to help me fill the cups?" I ask.
"Yeah,"
the girl says enthusiastically. I catch her mother's eye, and the woman gives me a nod. For a few minutes, Anna and I work in silence. All business now,
She separates the cups and slides one to me. I dip the spoon into the pudding and ladle a dollop into the cup. As people converge, I introduce myself and make small talk, doing my utmost to engage them. I share the recipe for the date pudding with the women who ask. I discuss Schrock's sermon with a couple of the men. And there's always the weather, which seems to be a favorite topic. After half an hour or so, the crowd at my table thins. Making sure Mary Gingrich is out of earshot, I turn my attention to the girl helping me. "I think everyone liked the pudding," I say.
"Brick Ivan had 2 cups,
the girl exclaims. "Brick Ivan?"
"His real name is just Ivan, but everyone calls him Brick because he lays bricks."
"Ah," I smile, trying to come up with a way to get her talking about Rachel Esch. "You said your friend Rachel liked date pudding, too."
"She helped me and Ma'am make it once."
"Were you good friends?" I'm not sure how close she was to Rachel Esch, and I don't want to upset her, so I tread carefully. Anna nods vigorously.
"She was my best friend."
"You must miss her."
"Yeah. Everyone thought she was too old to be my friend, you know, because I'm stunted. But my ma'am said that's okay, because God made me that way, and whatever God does is okay."
"Your ma'am is right." I shovel a spoonful of pudding into a cup and hand it to her. "What kinds of things did the two of you do together?" The girl's eyes light up as she digs into the pudding. She's a good little eater and gives me only half her attention as she chews.
"She played the clapping game with me. Me and my ma'am and Rachel made soap once."
"I bet that was fun."
"She was so pretty and grown up."
A wistful sigh.
"She smelled good, and she used to let me brush her hair."
"I bet she had lots of friends."
"Yeah, but I was her best."
I try again. "Who were her other friends?"
"Emma next door."
She lowers her voice and whispers in Pennsylvania Dutch.
"Don't tell, but Rachel told me Emma smells bad."
I can't help it. I laugh. "What about Marie Weaver?" I ask, recalling Suggs's notes.
"I almost forgot about her. Rachel loved Marie."
The girl's face scrunches up.
"I always thought Marie was kind of mean, though."
"Mean? How so?"
"I don't know."
She shrugs.
"My mom says Marie has a sharp tongue, and she's always getting into trouble."
"What kind of trouble?"
"She wears English clothes."
Again, the girl lowers her voice to a whisper.
"And she says bad words."
"I bet her parents don't like that."
"Neither does the bishop."
"The bishop? Really?" She glances left and right and whispers,
"Rachel told me he put Marie in the chicken coop."
I almost don't know what to say to that. "The chicken coop?" For the first time, wariness enters her expression, as if she's realized she's talking about something she shouldn't be talking about. Trying not to feel guilty for plying a kid with dessert, I add a small dollop of pudding to her cup.
"You mean to clean it?"
I ask.
"No, he locked her in."
"Why would he do that?" Her eyes skate away from mine.
"I'm not supposed to talk about that."
"You mean the chicken coop part, or Rachel?" She takes a big bite of pudding.
"I don't know,"
she says around the food. I help myself to some of the pudding, let the silence ride for a moment.
"How do you like the pudding?" "It's the best I ever had."
She stops mid-chew.
"Don't tell my ma'am I said that."
A wave of affection rolls through me, and I reach out and squeeze her shoulder. She's so innocent and unsuspecting. The kind of girl a counterpart might confide in or speak freely before, without the worry of repercussions. But does she know anything about Rachel Esch? I glance over at Anna, who's finished her pudding and is eyeing another cup.
"Is the chicken coop for teenagers who've misbehaved,
Or do bad chickens get put in there, too? I ask with a grin. The girl flashes a smile, then looks down, her shoulders curling in.
I don't know.
Her reticence hints that there's something there she doesn't wish to discuss, or has been told not to. I don't want to frighten her with too many questions, so I go to another topic.
Is Marie here today?
Twisting in her chair, she points at a girl sitting alone at another table, eating a wedge of rhubarb pie. The instant Anna points, the girl glances our way, as if knowing she's the topic of gossip. She gives Anna a withering glare, and then her eyes slide to mine. She's got auburn hair, brown eyes alight with intelligence, a sprinkling of freckles on an aquiline nose, a full mouth that's far too sensuous for a 16-year-old kid. She's unusual-looking and extraordinarily pretty, a troublesome combination, even if you're Amish. Rolling her eyes in that universal annoyed teenager way, she goes back to her pie.
She's pretty.
I place a spoonful of pudding into the next cup. I bet the boys like to court her.
She's mean to them, too.
Did any of the boys like Rachel?
She separates two cups, sets both in front of me.
Jacob Yoder.
I put the name to memory. Did they go to singings together? She looks at me as if I'm naive, and I remind myself not to underestimate her or how much she may know simply because she's special needs.
My mam says, harkt gut, aber folgt schlecht.
He hears well, but obeys poorly, which basically means he's willfully disobedient. Over the next 20 minutes or so, I try a few different angles with Anna, but she's grown bored with me, makes an excuse, and wanders away. The date pudding was a hit, and the container is empty. I keep an eye on the crowd as I pack things away. A dozen or so elderly women are seated at a folding table, drinking coffee and speaking quietly. Most of the men have gone to another section of the barn. Through a wide doorway, I see them standing around an ancient-looking manure spreader. Several groups of girls are scattered about, sitting at tables or packing leftover food and utensils. A couple of boys are breaking down tables, folding and stowing them. I glance toward the place where Marie Weaver had been sitting, but she's left. I'd wanted to meet Rachel's parents, Fanny and Samuel Esch, but I have no idea what they look like or if they're even here. Normally, a briefing would have included photographs of all the players involved. But since most Amish do not have their photos taken, I can't rely on recognition. I spot Mary Gingrich sitting at a table with some other women, one of whom is crocheting. Picking up my bags, I carry them over to the table.
Hi, Kate. Mary addresses the other women. This is Kate Miller. She just moved here from Holmes County.
All eyes turn to me. I smile demurely.
Hello.
Kate's a widow, Mary informs them.
Eyes averted, heads bowed slightly, and the women make a collective sound of sympathy.
How long ago did your husband pass?
A white-haired woman asks.
9 months, I reply. John and I wanted to move here, but he got sick.
You're here permanently?
The crocheting woman asks. I nod. I've rented Mrs. Bowman's trailer home.
You have children?
Another woman asks. It's a question I've fielded several times now. Children and family are the heart of Amish society. I purposefully look away, glance down at the tabletop.
No, it's just me.
The white-haired woman shakes her head. She's probably too kind to say it aloud, but I know what she's thinking. If you're Amish, unmarried, and without children at my age, you're living an unfulfilled life.
Welcome to Roaring Springs, Kate Miller.
A red-haired woman whose face is mottled with freckles offers a kind, sympathetic look.
My cousin Ruth lives in Berlin.
The crocheting woman looks up at me.
I was in Holmes County last summer for my Großmutter's funeral. It's beautiful, and the Amish are so friendly.
Lots of English or tourists, though.
the red-haired woman puts in. They come right up to you and start taking pictures. Gawking at the Amish as if they've never seen a plain person before, another asserts, and chuckles ensue. It's harmless small talk, but the nerves at the back of my neck tingle with unease, and I remind myself the Amish world can be a small one. While most adults don't use phones, they write letters. If one of them happens to mention me by name, I could have some explaining to do.
How did you like the preaching service?
A 30-something woman asks, looking at me from beneath impossibly long lashes. The group falls silent, and I realize this is the most important question I'll be asked today. I wait a beat, letting the anticipation build.
It was without blemish, I say.
Bishop Schrock observes the true ordinances of Christ. Heads nod, but not all of them, and I'm intrigued. My church district in Ohio was, I pause, as if seeking the perfect word, fallen. All the Amish were mixed in with the rest of the world. Some of our young people were confused, you know, drinking and smoking with their English friends.
Here, we are separate, the red-haired woman tells me.
Schrock protects us from the blind and perverted, says another.
It doesn't elude me that not all the heads nod in concurrence, and I realize not everyone agrees with that assessment. I spend 20 minutes with the women before excusing myself under the guise of needing a restroom break. I'm told there are 2 outhouses behind the barn, one for women and one for the men.
Just go through the barn door and to the left, Mary tells me. You can't miss them.
After being inside for over 3 hours with so many people and having to be on the entire time, I feel as if I can breathe the instant I step outside. The wind has kicked up and smells of wood smoke and snow. Clouds have gobbled up the sunshine from earlier. I shiver as I make my way around the side of the barn toward the rear. To my right, a dozen or so buggies are parked in a neat row. The 2 young hostlers stand nearby, watching me. I wave, but they turn away without returning the gesture. I reach the back of the barn and take the stone steps to a path of trampled snow that wends through the trees. 10 yards away, 2 white clapboard buildings stand side by side. The one to my right is marked Fraw, so when the path splits, I go right. The outhouse is exactly that, but more closely resembles the kind you might find in a park. After making use of the facilities, I walk to the rear of the building to see what's there. I find myself staring into an ocean of winter-dead trees tangled with vines and a few evergreens. To the west, the land dips down, and over the tops of the trees, I see the smooth white surface of a plowed field. Remembering the aerial photos, I realize that beyond the field is a good-sized creek. A shriek breaks the silence. I look around, try to discern the direction from which it came and the nature of the sound. Spotting tracks, I leave the walkway and follow them down the hill. I've only gone a few yards when I hear male laughter, youthful, more than one. I change direction slightly, my boots nearly silent against the snow. The trees open to a clearing where 4 Amish teenagers have gathered, 3 boys and 1 girl. At first, I think they've slipped away to hang out and have some harmless fun. Then, one of the boys lunges forward and shoves the girl using both hands. She reels backward, arms flailing, and lands on her behind in the snow. Instinct kicks in, and before I can stop myself, I move out of the trees. The 3 boys turn toward me, mouths open, arms loose. I see surprise on their faces. A topical uneasiness tells me they're not overly alarmed by my presence. The boy who shoved the girl casts me an annoyed glare. He's disappointed I had the gall to interrupt. I look at the girl, recognize her immediately. Marie Weaver. Are you all right? Getting to her feet, she brushes snow from her coat. I'm fine. I turn my attention to the boy who shoved her. He's about 19 years old, sandy hair, bad haircut, vivid blue eyes. An attitude I'm no stranger to, especially when it comes to young males pumped up on testosterone. He might have been attractive, if not for the angry patches of acne on his cheeks and the bad attitude in his eyes. "What's your name?" The question is out, in my cop's voice no less, an instant before I remind myself who I am and why I'm here. Amish women aren't pushovers, but they're not as assertive as I am, especially when it comes to men. In the periphery of my vision, I see the other boys exchange looks that relay the question, "Who the hell is she?" The one I'm addressing meets my gaze head-on and holds it. "Jacob Yoder." The boy who'd been courting Rachel Esch. "What are you doing out here?" I ask.
"We could ask you the same thing."
I glance over to the other boy to my left. Dark brown hair, too long with blunt-cut bangs, pale skin, brown eyes. A sharp retort dangles on my tongue, but I curb it. Instead, I stare hard at him until he looks away, and I turn my attention back to the girl. "What's going on?" She looks over her shoulder as if the answer lies somewhere within the trees. "We were just goofing off," she mumbles.
"Is that why he pushed you down?"
I ask. Yoder steps closer.
"I didn't.
I saw you." I stand my ground, and he doesn't come any closer.
"We were just playing around," Yoder says. "Ain't that right, Marie?"
I make eye contact with the girl. She looks down at her shoes.
"We were just playing."
A little voice inside my head warns, "Be careful."
"Who are you?"
The third boy, in his late teens with strawberry blonde hair, looks at his friends, emboldened by them.
"I ain't seen your face around here before."
"Yeah."
The dark-haired boy moves closer, stops a few feet away, looks me up and down.
"You're not even from around here, and you think you can tell us what to do."
Under any other circumstances, the last thing I'd do is give up ground, literally or figuratively. These young men are up to no good, and the cop inside me would like nothing better than to shove their bad attitudes down their throats. But I need to maintain the persona of a newly relocated, recently widowed Amish woman. Dropping my gaze, I take a step back. "I'm Kate Miller," I tell him. "I heard this girl call out, and I thought she needed help."
"Well, she don't need any help," Yoder tells me. "From you or anyone else."
He grins at the girl.
"She likes it rough. Ain't that so, Marie?"
I look at the girl. For the first time, I notice the red welt on her cheek, the anger and humiliation simmering in her eyes. I wonder if she has other marks in places no one can see.
"I could use some help loading my things into the buggy," I tell her. "Would you give me a hand?"
For an instant, she looks torn. She doesn't want to be here, and yet she doesn't want to acquiesce in front of these boys. I turn my attention to Yoder.
"You can help, too, if you'd like."
No one moves. No one replies. I look at Marie, sending a silent communication that she should come with me. She gives me nothing in return. Nodding at the boys, I turn and take a few steps toward the barn. When I glance back, I see the girl following. Raucous laughter chases us as we wend through the trees and take the path toward the barn. Neither of us speaks until we reach the outhouses.
"What was that all about?"
I ask as we step onto the stone walkway.
"We were just goofing off," she mumbles.
I motion toward her cheek.
"Is that how you got that mark on your face?" "I did that on a tree branch."
She stops walking and gives me a who-the-fuck-are-you-anyway look.
"Why do you care? I don't even know who you are."
"I just moved here." I jab a thumb in the general direction of the boys. "I don't like what I saw back there." She stares at me, her expression set and stubborn.
"You don't know what you saw."
"Maybe I ought to tell the bishop." Her mouth opens. Apprehension flashes in her eyes.
"That'll only make things worse."
"You didn't do anything wrong."
"The bishop doesn't like me."
"Why not?"
"I don't know.
He just doesn't. He thinks... She lets the words trail. Forget it.
Her body language tells me she doesn't want to go back to the barn, but she doesn't want to stand here talking to me either, so I let her off the hook.
I don't have anything that needs loading.
I wasn't going to help you with it anyway.
Making a teen's customary sound of annoyance, she turns and walks into the outhouse. I wait, trying to decide if I should ask her about Rachel Esch. According to Anna, the girls were best friends. If anyone has an insight into Rachel's life or her death, it's Marie. I go to the edge of the porch area and look out over the woods. Marie emerges a minute later, shoots me a nasty glare, and starts toward the barn without speaking. I fall into step beside her.
I just realized where I heard your name, I say slowly. You were the Esch girl's best friend.
She stops and swings around to face me.
How do you know about her? I thought you weren't from around here.
I keep my answer vague. One of the women inside was talking about what happened. I pause.
That explains why you're so sad. I'm not sad, she snaps.
You were friends.
Yeah, well, she's gone, so it doesn't matter, does it?
We continue toward the barn, but stop when we reach the concrete walkway where the roof extends out.
Do you know what happened to her? I ask.
No one does, she mutters.
Did those boys know her?
Everyone knows everyone around here. In case you haven't noticed, Roaring Springs is a small town.
She was too young to die.
Noticing dried grass on the sleeve of her coat, I brush it off.
And you're too young to be so sad.
Yeah, well, no one cares what you think.
I nod toward the woods where the boys are. Look, you don't know me, but I have a niece your age. If you ever get into trouble or need help, you can come to me. I'm staying at the Bowman trailer. Do you know where that is?
I don't need help from you or anyone else.
Casting me a disdainful look, she walks away.
You're wrong about one thing, I say to her back.
She keeps walking.
It matters, I call out.
She doesn't look back. Chapter 11. One of the unwritten rules of Amish etiquette is that you don't leave directly after the post-service meal. Sunday is the only day set aside for rest, and most take full advantage of the opportunity to visit with their neighbors and friends. By the time the Gingriches drop me off at the trailer, it's nearly 4 p.m. I've put in some long days in the course of my career. I've pulled all-nighters and worked around the clock more times than I can recall. I don't ever remember being as mentally exhausted as I am today. I've been on since this morning, unable to let down my guard even for a moment. Pretending to be someone you're not and trying to keep all the lies straight is taxing, to say the least. On the bright side, it was time well spent. Though I didn't learn anything earth-shattering, I met dozens of people and came one step closer to establishing my place in the community. The incident with Marie Weaver and the three boys niggled at the back of my brain all afternoon. It's true that some Amish teens fall prey to the same bad behaviors as their English counterparts. They're human and as fallible as anyone else. But generally speaking, the vast majority are well-behaved and respectful, especially when their elders are around. When I confronted Jacob Yoder, he was not only unrepentant, but defiant, as if he'd known there would be no repercussions. I was left with the impression that the incident wasn't an anomaly. I can't help but wonder if Rachel Esch knew them too, if she'd been treated with the same level of disrespect, or worse. On the surface, today's worship service had been typical. It would have been an enjoyable and fulfilling experience for any visitor. But I'm no ordinary visitor, and more than once, I'd sensed there was something off-kilter. Nothing I can put my finger on, but I felt a nearly indiscernible thread of tension, of watchfulness, maybe even paranoia. It's as if everyone was following some carefully written script,
and being cautious not to veer from it, especially when the topic of Eli Schrock arose. Every individual I met spoke highly of the bishop, his belief system, his kindness and generosity, his strength and leadership. But the reverence with which those words were uttered didn't quite ring true. There was something left unspoken. My own impressions of the bishop are mixed. He gave me no reason to harbor suspicion. He's a charismatic man, a natural leader, and outwardly friendly, while at the same time commanding respect. He's an enthralling speaker and delivered a rousing preaching service. He knows the Amish tenets and certainly wields the power to enforce them. All that said, when I looked into his eyes, I saw a flash of something unexpected. Tucked beneath the layers of benevolence and caring and a keen intelligence, I saw secrets. An innate darkness I've observed before, in the eyes of criminals. I'm trying to put all my observations into order and pin down the specifics of what's bothering me as I unlock the door and let myself into the trailer. More than anything, I want a hot shower and a few hours of downtime. I want to curl up on the sofa with my phone and a blanket and call Tomasetti. But there's one more thing I need to do before dark. I want to see the place where Rachel Esch's body was found. Towing off my boots, I pull on an extra pair of socks and put the boots back on. I run my hand over the .22 strapped to my thigh, find it secure. My phone is still tucked away in my coat pocket. Though it's only a little past 4, dusk is already settling in. As much as I don't want to get caught in unfamiliar woods after dark, I'm glad for the added cover. If someone catches me sniffing around the scene, I'll have some explaining to do. Locking the door behind me, I descend the steps and round the trailer to the rear. The backyard is small and fenced with chain link that's tangled with winter-dead vines. A rusty metal shed is nestled in the farthest corner. The door is bent and ajar, as if someone forced it open and didn't bother repairing it. I take a moment to look inside, but there's not much there. An old rotary push mower, a leaf rake, snow shovel, a few clay pots. I move on to the fence at the back, shove open the gate, and then I'm in the woods and heading north. I start off at a jog. It's not easy in muck boots and a dress, especially with 4 inches of snow on the ground. I can't imagine how silly I'd look to some casual observer. Luckily, I'm in the boonies, and chances are I won't run into anyone. My boots are nearly silent as I weave through the trees. Somewhere in the near distance, a hawk whistles. It's a melancholy, lonely sound in the silence of the forest. A light snow has begun to fall, and though my nerves are on alert, I can't help but admire the stark beauty all around me. I have only a general idea of my destination. Suggs told me the girl's body was found near the lake. The tree nearest her body was flagged with orange marking paint. He thought there might be some scraps of crime scene tape left as well. He wasn't sure. It doesn't take me long to reach the lake. It's a good-sized body of water, about 2 acres, and completely frozen over. A deer path runs alongside the water's edge. I cut over to the trail and continue on. The snowfall is just enough to dust my shoulders and head covering. It's cold, but the physical activity has warmed my core. Ever cognizant of the coming darkness, I maintain a brisk pace. It'll be fully dark in half an hour. If I don't find the scene quickly, I'll have to turn around and wait until tomorrow. I reach the end of the lake and stop, looking for the marking paint or any scrap of crime scene tape left behind. I turn, take a good look at my surroundings. I pick out a few landmarks, and then I leave the path and go left. I walk 50 yards, keeping my eyes on the tree trunks. When I think I've gone far enough, I go right for a few yards and then walk back toward the lake. I'm about to give up when, 20 yards from the north end of the water, I find the orange X on the trunk of a massive birch tree. Of course, there's nothing to indicate Rachel Esch had ever been there, but there are signs that this was the scene of a police presence. A 6-inch-long piece of yellow crime scene tape is tied around a sapling. Another piece is stapled to a larger trunk. The underbrush has been trampled, some of it cut away. I'm no stranger to crime, or the knowledge of the things human beings can do to each other. Even for an experienced cop, it's unsettling to stand in a place where you know someone died, especially when their death was at the hands of another. I wonder about the girl's final moments. Did she come out here alone and lose her way? Was the snow coming down too hard for her to find her way home? Was she lost, alone and afraid? Did she know she wasn't going to make it out of these woods alive? Or did someone make sure she didn't? Someone who, for reasons unknown, didn't want her to survive. I don't expect to make some profound discovery simply by looking at the scene. Nothing's ever that easy. But I've heard it said that some places have memories. I'm not sure I believe it, but it's almost always useful to visit a crime scene. I spend 15 minutes walking the area, trying to get a feel for it, the logistics of the surroundings, gain some sense of what might have transpired. Why would a 15-year-old Amish girl wander into the deep woods during a snowstorm? Where was she coming from? Where was she going? Was she alone? Running away from someone? To someone? I think about her recent pregnancy, the possibility of a home abortion. Did she do it herself? Or did someone help her? And who supplied her with the Oxycontin that showed up in the tox screen? I know one thing for certain. Rachel Esch kept a lot of secrets. I make a mental note to ask Suggs about the Oxycontin trade in the area, have him cross the names with some of the Amish I met today, see if any of them intersect. I walk the area a final time, but there's nothing there. Just the remnants of a police presence, the knowledge of a life lost before its time, and an unsolved mystery that will be forgotten all too soon if someone doesn't uncover the truth. "What happened to you?" I whisper, my voice sounding strange in the silence of the forest. I've just started toward the trailer when the toe of my boot nudges something beneath the snow. Kneeling, I brush away snow and pull out a faceless Amish doll. It's about 8 inches long. The fabric is tattered and dirty. Stitched into the material are the words, "Life beyond death." The odd inscription gives me pause. No one puts words like that on a child's doll. More than likely, they were sewn into the fabric subsequent to Rachel's death and left here as some kind of tribute after the crime scene people left. Someone had cared about Rachel Esch, mourned her death. Her parents? Her best friend, Marie Weaver? Her boyfriend? Or is this something else? The response of a guilty conscience from someone unknown? I don't have an evidence bag, so I drop the doll into my coat pocket. I'll pass it off to Suggs later. Chances are it won't tell us anything, but it's worth a closer look. It's fully dark now, and I'm thoroughly chilled. I've just started for the trailer when I hear the whine of an engine. According to the aerial photos, the nearest road is Swamp Creek Road, which is to the south. The sound of the engine is to the north. I'm pondering possible sources when headlights flicker through the trees. Not a car or truck, I realize, but a snowmobile. And it's coming this way. There's nothing sinister about a nighttime snowmobile ride. More than likely, it's someone out to have some fun in the snow. Still, I don't want to be seen here in the very spot where Rachel Esch's body was found. I glance around for cover. There are hundreds of trees, but not all of them are large enough to conceal me if the snowmobiler gets close. I spy a snarl of bramble at the base of an evergreen, dash over to it, and drop to my knees. The whine of the engine grows louder. Not one machine, but two. Headlight beams slash through the trees, shadows cartwheel against the trunks. I hunker down, the brush snagging my coat. The headlights flash over me and move on. The machines stop 20 yards away, engines rumbling. There are two people on each snowmobile. The drivers are wearing snowsuits and helmets. The passengers are smaller. Women, I realize. No helmets. Regular coats. The men are talking, loudly to be heard above the engines. I'm shocked to realize they're speaking Pennsylvania Dutch. They're too far away for me to catch all of the conversation. Something about a dirt road. I'm puzzling over these Amish men utilizing gasoline-engine-powered vehicles when one of the passengers launches herself from the snowmobile and throws herself into a sprint. Adrenaline burns through my gut when I realize her hands are bound in front of her. What the hell?
Stoba!
The man with whom she'd been riding yells. Stop!
Halt!
Sie ist am Springer!
Shouts the second driver. She's running! The man she'd been riding with unfastens his helmet, throws it to the ground, and vaults from the seat.
Stop!
He sprints after the woman. Even mired by the snow and his bulky clothes, it takes him only a few strides to catch her. He takes her down in a full-bodied tackle. The woman makes a muffled sound, her face crushed into the snow. The man gets to his knees, flips her onto her back, and straddles her.
Stupid woman, he shouts. Get on the machine.
She spits snow in his face and shouts something in a language I don't recognize. He draws back and slaps her in the face. 100 scenarios snap through my brain. Is this some kind of domestic dispute? Are these people intoxicated? Or is something more sinister going on? For a split second, I debate whether to intervene. Of course, if I do, I risk blowing my cover. But there's no way I can stand by and let that son of a bitch assault her. The man takes the decision away from me when he punches her a second time. I jump to my feet. Leaving the cover of the trees, I whistle.
Here, boy! Come on, boy!
Then I'm walking toward them, using my hand to shield my eyes from the glare of the headlights.
Hello?
I call out, making an effort to lose my cop persona. It's not easy. Nothing pisses me off more than seeing a bully punch the shit out of a woman.
Who's there?
I call out in Pennsylvania Dutch. 4 heads swivel in my direction. The man on top of the woman jumps to his feet. The other man, still sitting on the snowmobile, swings his legs over the saddle and gets off. I hear him tell the woman behind him to stay put. I don't see any weapons, but that doesn't mean they're not armed. The Amish generally don't own handguns, but these men are a far cry from typical.
Who are you?
The man who'd punched the woman starts toward me. He's wearing a ski mask, so I can't see his face, but his body language tells me he's pissed off that I've interrupted. I'm aware of the .22 against my thigh as he closes the distance between us. Stopping, I watch him approach. He's young, no beard that I can see, which means he's not married. I don't like the look of him, angry and high on adrenaline.
I'm Kate Miller,
I motion behind me.
I live down the road. I saw a stray dog. He looked cold and lost.
I cock my head, the way a suspicious Amish woman might.
What are you doing on those machines?
I ask in Pennsylvania Dutch. The two men exchange glances.
We ain't seen no dog.
The man who'd punched the woman stops 10 feet away from me, looks me up and down.
You probably saw a coyote.
I look past him at the fallen woman and switch to English.
Was there an accident here? Are you injured?
I motion toward the snowmobile, then turn my attention to the man.
Isn't it against the Ordnung for you to be riding them?
The woman stares at me, mouth open, breaths puffing out in a vaporous white cloud, a small dribble of blood on her chin. I can tell by the way she's looking at me that she's frightened, that she doesn't understand English or Pennsylvania Dutch. The man sets his hand on her shoulder and pulls her against him so that her bound hands are out of sight. I pretend not to notice and address the woman directly.
Did you fall off the machine?
When she doesn't respond, I turn my attention to the man.
Look at her, I scold. She's cold and hurt.
I start to go to her, a mother hen whose chick has been pecked by an aggressive rooster.
She's fine.
The man steps toward me, blocking my way.
We don't need your help.
I stop.
Go home, lady, the second man calls out. You're trespassing on Schrock land.
I'm sure Bishop Schrock will be interested to know about these machines, I shoot back. The man who'd hit her moves closer. For an instant, I think he's going to lay into me. Behind the ski mask, his eyes blaze with fury. I brace, remind myself the 22 is in easy reach. But he stops, gives me another once-over.
She's fine. Now get out of here. There ain't no dog out here.
The woman says something in a language I don't recognize. Eastern European, maybe. She's young, barely 20. This is not a domestic situation. I'd lay odds she doesn't know the man she's riding with. But there's little I can do. I look away, pretend I didn't hear her. But my heart is pounding, my brain churning. What the hell is going on? I can tell by the way the men are acting that my presence is making them nervous. Not because they've broken Amish rules, but because they're up to no good and don't want a witness. The man nearest me looks like he's considering doing something about it. I step back, putting some space between us. You sure she's okay?
She's fine, the man tells me. She drinks too much. I'm taking her home, that's all.
I give the woman a judgmental look.
De siffer hot zu viel geleppert.
The drunkard has sipped too much.
That's what happens, I guess.
The man points in the general direction of the road.
Go on, get out of here.
I put their physical descriptions to memory as best I can. Turning away, I start toward the trailer. Behind me, I hear the man order the woman back onto the snowmobile. The twin engines rev. Once I'm in the trees, I stop and turn. Through the trunks, I catch a glimpse of the woman's face. The cop inside me winces at the thought of letting them go. But I do, watching them fade into the darkness. When they're gone, I turn toward home and break into a run. I'm still out of breath when I call Suggs. Quickly, I take him through everything I saw and give him the physical descriptions of all four individuals. The men were wearing ski masks beneath their helmets, so I don't know what they looked like.
Of course they were,
he mutters darkly.
You're certain the women weren't Amish?
They weren't wearing Amish clothes. They didn't know Pennsylvania Dutch. I don't even think they knew English.
Well, that's puzzling as hell.
He goes silent a moment.
A couple of young Amish guys with foreign women? Is it possible they're on Rumspringa and picked up, dates? Some of those kids, especially the boys, can get pretty wild.
I thought of that, but I don't think that was the case. Dan, I saw one of the men strike the woman he was with. Her hands were bound.
Shit.
We fall silent. I can practically hear our thoughts zinging over the line.
Were the men armed?
Not that I could see. No rifles. But they were wearing snowsuits, so hard to tell. And those snowmobiles were nice ones. New. Polaris.
Not cheap.
Why would young Amish men have snowmobiles? I ponder.
I suppose they could have borrowed them.
But he doesn't sound convinced.
Were they part of Schrock's group?
Maybe. They told me I was on Schrock's land and that I was trespassing.
Did you get a tag number?
He asks.
In New York State, snowmobile owners are supposed to display their registration number with a plate or decal.
I looked, but it was dark, and the headlights were blinding me. One of the machines was silver and blue. Couldn't see the other one well enough to tell.
A lot of snow machines up here this time of year.
I'm still thinking about the women. Are there any pockets of non-English-speaking immigrants in the area? Eastern European, maybe?
We have a few immigrants here and there, but no concentrated pockets.
Is there a snowmobile dealer in town?
There's one in Malone.
Could you check with them and see if any Amish have purchased machines?
Good idea. I'll do it.
I'll call you tomorrow. I disconnect and look around the darkened trailer. It's cold and smells of mildew and kerosene. I light the lantern on the bar, but it does little to penetrate the shadows. I take a few minutes to settle down, then carry the phone to the sofa and dial Tomasetti's number. He picks up on the first ring.
Hey, Chief,
he says.
How's it going up there on the tundra?
I'm sitting here in the dark and cold, missing you.
Hmm. Sounds tough. Are you wearing a dress?
I smile. Yes.
Head covering?
I can't help it. I laugh. Tomasetti, are we having phone sex?
I'm pretty sure we are.
This dress is a bit of a stretch.
This is about the woman, not the dress,
he tells me.
Besides, I have a good imagination.
Good thing. But I can hear the smile in his voice. He misses me too, I realize. The thought warms me from the inside out.
You all settled in?
He asks. As settled in as I can be in a 12x50, circa 1980 trailer.
Sounds homey.
If you like caves.
How's the assignment going?
I tell him about attending worship earlier in the day. The women I met in town, Mary Gingrich and Laura Hirschberger.
Quilting? Worship? You like living on the edge, don't you?
I laugh again. Tomasetti, it's really good to hear your voice.
That's what all the female chiefs of police tell me.
Just for the record, you're full of shit.
They usually tell me that, too.
I debate whether to get into the incident in the woods. I don't want to darken the conversation. More important, I don't want to worry him when I'm so far away. But I need his opinion, so I lay it out. There's no doubt something unsavory was going on. At the very least, an assault. I feel like I should have done something about it.
You are. You're there, trying to figure out what's going on.
I hadn't thought about it that way, but he's right. Still, it isn't an immediate fix, and that part of it doesn't sit well with me.
So, what's your take on the Amish community there?
He asks. Friendly, welcoming. I try to find the right words. Can't. But I'm getting some odd vibes.
How so?
Still trying to pin it down. Outwardly, people are fiercely supportive of Schrock, almost too supportive. I'm not sure everyone is being honest about their feelings. I guess I'm sensing some undertones of discontent.
What's your take on Schrock?
He's charismatic, intelligent, personable, commanding, hell of a preacher.
Joel Osteen meets Amish Mafia.
Leave it to Tomasetti to make me laugh about something that really isn't funny. That's one of the things I love about him.
He's very old order.
One of the women told me there's no plumbing in any of the houses on his land. Their dresses have to be a certain length, and only a few colors are approved. No slow-moving vehicle signs on the buggies, steel wheels, no windshields, no gas or kerosene-powered engines, even on the dairy farms.
Makes the appearance of those snowmobiles even more baffling.
Exactly. I'm still thinking about Schrock. Interestingly, he practices my dung.
Shunning?
Right. Only he takes it to the extreme. Usually, social avoidance is used to bring the wayward souls back into the fold. Schrock doles it out as punishment. He bans for life and for relatively minor offenses.
Sounds like you don't want to find yourself on his shit list.
If he only knew, right? Tomasetti pauses.
If you want to make points with Schrock, maybe you ought to tell him about the two guys on snowmobiles.
You're right. It'll give me an excuse to visit his farm and talk to him.
Might make you an enemy or two,
he says.
Something to keep in mind.
I'm not here to make friends.
Will you do me a favor before you start beating the beehive?
If I can.
Watch your damn back.
Chapter 12. When I was a kid, my brother Jacob would help our neighbors bale hay for extra cash. The summer he turned 13, he used that money to buy his first bicycle. My sister Sarah and I, being females, were handed down his skateboard. I wasn't very good at sharing, and spent a good bit of time haggling with Sarah, trying to convince her I should be the one to ride it. I was a persuasive child, and most of the time, I got my way. I loved that skateboard. It gave me the freedom I craved, but got me into a lot more trouble than my parents bargained for. Of course, My short-lived love affair with that skateboard was 25 years ago. Now, looking down at the kick scooter propped against the deck rail, I'm pretty sure I'm going to kill myself with it. The Schrock farm is only half a mile away, and the roads are clear, so I decide to try it. The day is overcast, with temperatures hovering in the mid-20s, so I'm bundled up. Knowing Schrock is strict with regard to dress, I don my longest black dress and black winter head covering and strike out at 9 a.m., with the hope that I don't bust my ass on the way. I take the same route the Gingriches took yesterday, and it takes me just 10 minutes to reach the mouth of the lane. The gravel is too rough for the scooter, so I park it on the shoulder and strike out on foot. There are several inches of old snow striped with buggy wheel marks. Around me, the woods echo with birdsong, and I hear the whistle of a hawk in the distance. I pass by the clapboard schoolhouse and the barn where worship services were held the day before. An Amish woman in a gray dress and black coat is sweeping the concrete beneath the covered porch.
Guter Maria,
I wish her a good morning as I approach. She responds in kind, and I'm relieved to be greeted with a smile.
Wie geht's allweil?
How goes it now?
I'm Kate Miller. We met yesterday at worship. You're the young widow from Ohio.
She bows her head slightly.
What brings you here this morning?
I'm looking for the bishop. She blinks, and I detect surprise in her eyes.
Is he expecting you?
I smile. Do I need an appointment?
Of course not. But if he's in council...
Letting the words trail, she looks at me with a little more scrutiny.
Is everything all right?
Yes. I just need to speak with him about something that happened last night. Curiosity flashes in her eyes. I smile inwardly. The Amish may be pious, but they share all the same human weaknesses as the rest of us, including a propensity for nosiness.
Something that will concern him?
She asks.
I lean a little closer. I saw two young Amish men on snowmobiles.
Looking in both directions, I lower my voice conspiratorially.
They were with women. Englishers, I think. Bishop Schrock has been known to be a little more lenient with the young men, she tells me, especially if they're on Rumspringer. These men are older. I think one of them wore a beard.
I don't know that for a fact. I couldn't see his face because of the ski mask. But a married Amish man, gallivanting with strange women, makes for a more interesting story and will hopefully expedite access to Schrock and get the tongues wagging in the process. She presses her lips together. I can't tell if she's displeased by the news or with me for relaying it.
What makes you think that's something he'll be interested in?
I laugh outright.
They were riding motorized vehicles. I'm sure that's against the Ordnung.
Stepping away from me, she goes back to her sweeping.
I don't see why that's any of your concern. You're not a member of the congregation yet, are you?
I will be. I pause, but she says nothing.
I saw one of the men strike the woman he was with.
I add a bit of attitude to my voice.
Do you think the bishop will be interested in that?
She stops sweeping and looks at me as if she'd like nothing more than to hit me with the broom. Instead, she shakes her head.
The house is that-a-way.
She motions to a point farther down the lane.
Big farmhouse on the left. Can't miss it.
The trees thicken as I make my way down the lane, and a sense of isolation surrounds me. 200 yards in, the branches curl overhead like black, arthritic fingers. I'm starting to wonder if the not-so-helpful woman gave me the wrong directions when I spot the old farmhouse nestled in the trees to my right. It's a two-story brick structure that's been painted white with a tin roof. No shutters, no winterized flower beds, no landscaping to speak of. Just hundreds of trees, and farther back, a massive bank barn, and what looks like a good-sized coop where a dozen or so hens scratch and peck at the yellow grass poking up through snow mottled with chicken shit. A big dog of indistinguishable pedigree lumbers over to me, ears flopping, tongue lolling, emitting the occasional woof. He doesn't look like a biter, or much of a watchdog for that matter, but I give him a wide berth and head toward the front door. I step onto a wood plank porch that's been painted gray. My boots thud softly as I make my way to the door and knock. A young Amish woman opens the door. I guess her to be in her late teens. Pretty face, big brown eyes. She's dressed modestly in a dark gray dress, black apron, and cap. Plain clothes only go so far when it comes to obscuring the feminine silhouette, and this girl is hugely pregnant. Interesting.
Guter Maria, I begin. Good morning.
She opens the door wider. The smell of vinegar wafts out, and I realize she's cleaning.
Guter Maria.
Her voice is soft, like a child's. I'm Kate Miller. I live down the road. I wait, but she doesn't respond.
Are you Bishop Schrock's daughter?
I ask. She looks down at the broom. I notice her red chapped hands, nails chewed to the quick.
I just clean for him, she tells me.
I want to ask her age, but fearing too many questions will set off red flags, I don't.
What's your name?
Esther.
What's your last name?
The girl looks away, doesn't respond.
Okay.
I clear my throat.
Is the bishop here? I need to speak to him.
In the barn.
She motions toward the bank barn, looking relieved to be rid of me.
Donkey.
She closes the door without responding. I leave the porch, cross the wide gravel area, and start toward the barn. One of the big sliding doors stands open. Inside, I see the silhouette of a horse in cross ties standing in the aisle. A young Amish man is next to the horse, bent at the waist. As I draw closer, I hear the clang of a hammer against steel, and I realize he's shoeing the horse. A second animal is tethered to the stall door, awaiting its turn. Hello, I say to him as I step into the shadows of the barn. The farrier lowers the horse's hoof to the ground and straightens. He's thickly built, with bright blue eyes and a clean-shaven face, which tells me he's unmarried. Though it's cold this morning, he's removed his overcoat and wears a black jacket over work trousers, a blue work shirt, and suspenders.
Hello,
he says.
Is Bishop Schrock around?
I ask. He nods toward the back part of the barn.
He's unloading hay.
Donkey.
I run my hand over the horse's rump as I pass, its coat warm and soft beneath my palm. I find Schrock standing in a hay wagon that's been backed up to the rear door. His back is to me. He's using a pitchfork to drop loose hay from the bed of the wagon to several horses in the paddock below.
Hello? Bishop Schrock?
Slowly, he turns to me. His dark eyes zero in on mine with startling directness. He's clad in black, overcoat, jacket over a white shirt, work pants, black felt hat. He doesn't